ICMP, Internet Control Message Protocol, is a low-level mechanism that influences the behavior of UDP and TCP, as well as informing hosts of routing updates and routing troubles, and it can slow or redirect connections, and it supports the ping, the ping protocol, which is what's commonly used to identify whether or not a computer exists and is operational.
If we could stop beeping, I would appreciate it. Beep so much.
When I tell us my kids, they go beep, beep, beep.
We get all these people beeping.
Beep, 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 beep. So what makes a packet an ICMP packet is that it has the version in the left and then a zero in the third and fourth bytes of the header, and a one in the third and fourth bytes of the third octet
of the IP packet header.
Therefore, it is deemed an ICMP packet.
And there are a variety of bad things that can happen.
For example, it's used for routing advertising. Right? So you say, I'm a router, I'm a router, I'm a router. So if you just want to claim that you're a router, they'll believe you masquerade as a default router. They believe you, they route through you.
You can watch all their traffic, you can modify the traffic on route.
You can, there's this network, host, port, and protocol unreachable. So all you need to do is send out a message that says port unreachable, protocol unreachable, host unreachable, network unreachable. And by sending out these messages, assuming that the other hosts are listening, a forger can cause the network to basically sever itself,
to refuse traffic. Oh, gee, I can't reach it. Right? You in this network that you were messing with this morning, you had host unreachable, even though you know the host is reachable. But it says host unreachable. Okay, so I can do that intentionally by forcing these ICMP packets into the address space. The source quench, which is one of my favorites. Source quench is what is used as a protocol when the other guy's going too fast. Okay? If they're sending you packets too quickly for you to handle them, and you're dropping packets in the network, or in an ATM network, you might drop cells, or in an Ethernet, you might be getting too many hits, too many packets coming into the network at the same time, and it's called collisions. If you get too many collisions, you need to slow down traffic in order to allow signals to get through, so you use source quench as one of the protocols. So what you can do is start sending source quench. And say, slow down, slow down, slow down, until they slow down to a crawl, until they slow down to they don't send me any more packets for a long time. Just by sending source quench packets. Redirect. This is how you tell the network or the host or the type of service to route through somewhere else. So instead of going through the way you thought you were going to go, your default route or the route is set up in the routing table, I'm going to redirect it. Go through here. So if you're on the same LAN segment, you say, redirect through here, and they'll send their packets to you instead of sending it to the router. And then you forward it to the router, and again, you become an active tap-to-tap, or perfect for man-in-the-middle attacks. And of course, if you do it on the internet, instead of routing through the normal routing, they might just, you know, route all the way to you, and you can then route back out to the world on your internet connection. So you, in theory, can grab any host out on the internet and cause them to route through you.
ICMP is an integral part of IP. Internet protocol cannot exist without the Internet Control Message Protocol. It's so deeply embedded into everything that operates. It also means that everything that claims to be IP is required to have this functional in some way. Now, some firewalls knock that off, but normally you can't completely eliminate it. You still have IP work, or you have to do something about it. All IP host networks are vulnerable for these sorts of exploitation. And if you want details, you can see RFC 792 or 1256 or various other
requests for comments. Remember, RFC is request for comments. So notice, by the way, that there's never actually a comment about a request for comments. Right? I would figure if there are RFCs, there should be this area called C, which is everybody's comment on the request for comments. And they should have comments like, you know, who's the moron that did this? But they don't. Because they don't want that,
I guess. Right, so assuming that ICMP is all doing this thing, then you can get UDP packets. UDP is User Datagram Protocol. And it was originally intended to extend IP service to user programs. So that,
you know, you had this low-level mechanism for shoving datagrams around the network,
and now you wanted to provide a user a way to send data between one user application and another.
So user datagram protocol is this, and what it does is it lets you send a datagram
from any IP address to any other IP address.
You just stick the to address and into the packet, of course, into the datagram. You don't have to stick the from address, but if you want to, you certainly can. And you shove it out into the network and it delivers it.
Or does that effort. There is no error correction in UDP service, nothing built in. So if somebody modifies a bit or two or 10 or 50, so what?
There's no error correction. Nothing's going to be fixed on the way, it's just going to get there.
There's no retransmission built into the protocol.
So if somebody loses a packet or a datagram, so what? It's lost. Okay, so it's not reliable in that sense.
Error detection is optional, which in practice means not done.
There's essentially no error detection on UDP packets.
There's no flow control. Nothing there that says stop or go or
continue. There's no,
there's essentially no nothing. You send this datagram out and might get there, and if it does, that's nice. Okay, you know, just to give you an example of what protocols run over UDP, there's DNS, the domain name service,
which is how you translate names to IP addresses and IP addresses to names. That runs over UDP.
So the domain name service has no error correction, no retransmission, no error detection, no flow control, basically no reliability features. And yet that is fundamental to the operation of most of the internet as it exists today. There's low overhead. The good thing about UDP is there's low overhead. If the datagram shows up, you read it, it stands on its own, you either send back the results or ignore it, it's up to you, and that's how it works.
The port and server information is just like in TCP. You give it a port number, 0 through 65,000, whatever, 535, whatever the magic number is, through the something or another, 16. Minus one, right?
Something like that. And let's see, so 217 minus one, I guess. So that all works the same. The ports below 1024, by convention, are only for root authorized users.
However, of course, that doesn't apply in this environment where everybody has their own workstation, because you are root on your workstation.
But on a multi-user system, you can do something to control those things. All transmissions are stateless.
Okay, so that when you send out a datagram, the other machine on the other side isn't supposed to remember any state information. There's nothing there that it remembers about the last datagram you sent. It's all self-enclosed. Whatever it is, it's here. It's in this datagram. If there's anything else you want to include, you better put it here, or it's going to be ignored at the other side, or it's likely to be ignored. And there's, of course, no authentication whatsoever. And now this isn't just my meanderings on it, this is what the RFC says, right?
So if you should accidentally, put authentication of some sort into one of these UDP things,
it would not be a UDP packet, because that would not meet the definition of what a UDP packet is.
There's an example contained in the data area of an IP datagram. So you have an IP datagram, within it there's the UDP portion, and there's this UDP code in the header of the TCP datagram that says this is a UDP protocol, subprotocol. And it has a source port, a destination port, a length, a checksum, and a bunch of data. The length is, I believe, the length of the whole UDP packet in offset. Naturally, everything's in offset in sets of 8-byte things. You need to multiply or divide by 8, depending on what you're doing. And of course, if you can't fill it, if you don't have that many bytes,
you just have some 0 bytes or other bytes at the end. Who cares?
It's up to you to enforce whatever you want to enforce. Checksum is a simple checksum, just a standard simple checksum. Normally, the source port is the port on the sending machine that this originated from, with the notion being that when it gets to the destination port on the receiving machine, if they want to answer, they would send something back to the port number that was the sending port, and that's how you would establish a two-way communication.
And this follows RFC 768, is where this is all specified in detail.
Then we have DNS,
domain name service, domain name system, also known as Bind. There's a program called Bind that runs on most computers that does the functions associated with the domain name service for those computers. And it's defined by RFC 1035. Basically, it's a big distributed database. Okay, so that and it's a tree-structured database so that there's a root of the domain name service system. Domain name system, but it's no longer true. They're now moving towards a system that doesn't have a single root. It actually has multiple roots for different subsets of domain. In fact, that's been there for a long time. So the .mil, what you're used to is .mil and .gov and .com and .edu and .jp for Japan and so forth are now moving towards separate roots for the domain tree, which complicates things considerably. We'll look at it. It maps the IP number, the IP address, into a host name, or a host name into an IP address. So if I want to look up all.net, I can say something like nslookup, name service lookup, all.net, and it'll come back with an IP address. Okay, this happens by a UDP packet that you send off to some domain name server, and eventually however it figures it out, you get back an answer with another UDP packet. So if I should happen to just want to convince you that all.net is somewhere it's not, and I decide to target your machine, all I need to do is start sending back a bunch of responses to DNS queries as if you had made one. Eventually, you might pick one of those responses up and assume all.net's the wrong place and go use it. So that would be a way to trick you if you use names instead of IP addresses into sending things the wrong place. So, now, because you can go from host name to IP and from IP to host name, some people use that duality to do a cross-check. So if I get an IP and it claims to be from a host name, I go look up the host name, check that I get the IP address, look up the IP address, check that I get the host name. If they don't match each other, I declare that the DNS is wrong, and I say I'm not going to deal with you. Or I deal with you appropriately for somebody that may have been lying about something. TCP wrappers has this built in. We'll talk a little bit about TCP wrappers later in this course. It uses UDP queries to DNS servers, so they're unreliable, unauthenticated, and so on and so forth. All those properties of UDP that we smile at in the last couple of slides. You can reply with two things. You can either say, here's the answer, or you can say, I don't know the answer, but I will refer you to this other domain name server over here. So I don't actually have to be able to lie about the answer if I can convince another domain name server simply to refer the answer to me. Now, how does it know where to refer the answer to? And the answer to that question is that they have this system of sending around the I own this and you own that and who owns what domain. Okay, so that's also unauthenticated, also UDP. So if I can simply send information to one of these domain name servers out in the internet, I can convince it that I am the root of the internet. And from now on, all your requests will come to me. And I can service them. In fact, that's what somebody did in an attack against the InterNIC. They decided they didn't like the InterNIC being in charge, so they crashed that server, declared themselves root of the world, and they were serving the internet for a period of time. They got arrested. They were up in Canada. Now, I don't know why they were arrested, because I don't know why it is that anybody would say that there's actually any right of anybody to claim that they own the internet, or that they own the root of their domain service. There's no legal right, as far as I can tell, to ownership of domain name service on the internet. In fact, if you wanted to, you could set up a box and claim that you are the root of the .fred domain. Okay? I'm the root server for the whole internet of .fred, and a subset of .fred is .com. Right? So .com, that's .com.fred. We just default it to .com for you, so for your convenience, but it's actually .com.fred, and .fred is the whole internet. No problem. You can do that. You can set up a DNS that does that. It will work just fine. If you can get other people to refer packets to, refer DNS lookup to you, you win. You own the internet. Okay? Now, if you try it, there will be some resistance, and in fact, ultimately, they'll squash you because people with lots of money are now into the internet thing, and they want to squash people that are trying to take their money from them by owning that stuff. I mean, right now, when you register a domain name, it's $75 per year or for 2 years. There are hundreds of millions of domain names. Okay, that's tens of billions of dollars a year that goes to network solutions, and you know what they do for it? They don't remove your entry from the table in their DNS server. That's what they do, is they don't remove it. And they try to keep the two or three boxes that actually run domain name services operating. But if they fail, which they do periodically, so what? It's no big deal. They just bring them back up. Somebody else will take over the service for a while until they come back, and then they'll go as two together. Okay. Very easy. All right, so, but it's worth, you know, big money out here. It's a tree-structured namespace, so the internet might point to .com, .net, and so forth. So if I was, for example, in a place called sp.com, which is some company out on the internet, and I wanted to look up all.net, then sp.com might have their own domain name server. So the first place it would look, if you said find all.net, first thing we do is look for all.net.sp.com, in the sp.com domain service. If it didn't have an all.net.sp.com, it would go out here to .com and look for all.net.com. If there was no all.net.com, then it would go to the internet, and that would say, well, here's the authoritative server for the .net. It would look here, and it was all.net, and that would point you to some domain name server that's probably a .netcom these days, or it's, what's it called, Mindspring, wherever it is, wherever it's hosted. And that domain name server will then say, all.net's over here. And give you an IP address, which you could then use to route packets. So your computer would translate the name into the IP address and go through the network. Now, there's a little problem, and that is if you look that up for every packet, you'd be doing a whole lot of lookups for a whole, you know, almost no packets. So typically what happens is there's a caching system. Each of the domain name services caches some number of the previous lookups, but the more commonly used one, your computer remembers what the IP address is for all.net once you've gone there. Okay, now of course, that means that if I should ever change the IP address of all.net, all these people that remember it out there in the internet will take some time to meet the change. So normally to do a changeover, you need to keep the old one up for a period of time, make a copy of the new one, wait till the changeover takes effect, and then cut out the old one, and then still handle occasionally the human options. In fact, so one of the ways, you notice, for example, on one of these computers over here, you're having problems in looking these things up because you don't have a domain name service that's set up for what you're doing, and you don't want to use the real domain name service because it's sitting behind your firewall. So what you do is, let's see, normally you can configure your domain name system, the bind program, to look things up in different orders. So typically what you do is the first place you look is in the /etc/hosts file, or in a Windows box in the whatever, I think it's the /c:\windows/hosts. And so there you can manually configure it so that you say all.net is whatever address you want it to be, and as far as your computer is concerned, that's what it is, and it will never look it up anywhere. If all.net moves, it's your job to update your host file. But in fact, of course, one of the things you can do is just flat lie. Right? You can, if you guys want to have your own version of all.net, you can put an entry in your host file or make your own DNS that says all.net's actually here, and that'll take care of it. And anybody that goes there, well, that's where they'll look for all.net. Is your domain server claims to be authoritative, or your host file claims to be authoritative? Or you can put in a firewall so that when DNS requests come to that firewall looking up some address in the internet, you give your response. Okay, and it'll think that's your address. So, for example, you could create a firewall that when DNS inquiries came in, domain name system inquiries came in, looking for anything out on the internet, it would refer it to one of your internal IP addresses, which would then proxy all those IP addresses out to the internet and bring back the answers. Okay? You could, of course, you know, just sort of create a fiction. You know, so when they go to whitehouse.com, which is a pornography site, it actually gives it the IP address of whitehouse.gov, which is the White House that we think of as the White House. So that from behind your firewall, there would be no whitehouse.com. Whitehouse.com would actually be whitehouse.gov, which is what you probably thought you were looking for. Unless, of course, you weren't. In which case, you would be disappointed and have to actually go look up the IP address. So, with this in mind, we've talked about some of the bad things that can happen in the domain name service. Services include address of a host, main server delegated to another host, start of authority, these are records. It also handles mail exchange. So you have all these hokey mail addresses, right? Like, you know, a mail address like, you know, fred@world.com or something. There is no world.com, or there might not be some world.com server. Instead, world.com might just be some mail exchange record sitting in some domain name system somewhere that says, yeah, world.com, actually, you refer it to George's house, .net.japan or something. And that's where it goes. The mail exchange record. And this is very handy because when you, for example, change an email address, you can rig a mail exchange address, a mail exchange pointer, so that people trying to send mail to somebody in your organization that doesn't exist anymore get forwarded somewhere else. Right? When they move from a different, from one mail server to another in the domain name system, you can refer them to the proper email domain name server. So a lot of people use mail exchange records to redirect email, which changes as people move and so forth. It changes fairly often. Very common service. There's various host information. For example, these days there's lots of host information. Sometimes you look up a host and you'll find out name and address of the owner, telephone number, you know, who's in charge of the system, what hours they're in, whatever they want to provide. There's the so-called casual name of the host. So, for example, ca.sandia.gov is California, because it's been on the internet, you know, since it was the ARPANET, and there were only like 18 hosts. So, you know, California is actually recognized by almost every host everywhere as being that particular IP address. In fact, in some cases, it's directly into the host files of boxes that are 30 years old, or 20, 25 years old. And there are others. I think there's, what's another one besides California? I think CMU has such a thing, and there are a couple of others that are sort of globally recognized names. But for the most part, the casual names are things that you assign only in your own host's file, and it's for your convenience. So, for example, in my host file, I have something called CAC, which is the CAC network. And so when you want to go to it, you just say telnet space CAC. You don't have to give it domain names. It doesn't have to be in your domain name space. It doesn't look through the DNS system to try and find something called CAC somewhere. It's just this name that I use for my convenience. So there's various conveniences you can create in encryption. But of course, if the CAC network ever moves, all I do is change it in the host file, and it still works. All of my functions work. So the other thing I'll do is have functional things in my host file. So maybe I'll have something called mail. And if I change mail service providers, it'll still be called mail. So it always goes to mail whenever I want to go to mail. So I can just add conveniences into these files as long as I'm willing to go through the overhead of continuing to keep those standards working. It can make my life a lot easier and everything's more convenient for me and my users. There's also a pointer to map IP addresses back to host names. Now that's sort of strange because sometimes an IP address has multiple host names. You look up the IP address and you get 47 names. So there's a variety of stuff like that. So of course DNS records can be forged and DNS machines can get forged updates. Okay, so if I send forged updates into a box, it'll incorrectly associate domain name information and redirect your attempts to connect from the box you're at to some other box to go through the box that I want you to connect to. So, for example, if in ST.com, they create something called all.net.ST.com, then it'll go into there, or I can just put something in the domain server for ST.com that says all.net is actually at this address, which is, you know, face.gov's address. And from then on, whenever anybody in the ST.com domain tries to go to all.net, their DNS will say it's over here, this face.gov site, that's government site, and we'll listen into that traffic. And in fact, if they want, they can forward it off to all.net and just sit in the middle and observe all the traffic. Okay? So DNS forgery is a very powerful way of getting people to redirect traffic through you. And of course, since it's relatively easy when you get a packet incoming, to just redirect it off to somewhere else, especially with this capability to have one machine have multiple IP addresses, you can set up a whole Class B network and have every address in there correspond to some internet site. Forge the DNS information, and whenever people come, look at the IP address they're coming to, reroute it out, make the request to the other machine, get the answer back and shove it back, and keep track of what they're doing, what they're accessing. If they're using cookies, keep track of the cookies. If they're using supposedly secure services, no problem. You allow them to encrypt to you, and then you re-encrypt on the other side to the other guys, and some man in the middle attack against all their crypto systems. and you can defeat all the money exchange, pick up their credit card information, so on and so forth. Okay, so getting into the domain name service in this way is very nasty. And of course, there's no protection,
which makes it even more common. A domain name resolution starts with a partial name, like all.net, and then it assumes a local domain, so it'll be like all.net.local.net.com. Then it tries less local, all.net.net.com, then all.net.com, then all.net. Okay, so if you just create all.net.local.net.com and forge, you can do that and forge all.net, because that's how the lookup process will work.
So if in your little network here, you just configured your DNS to have all.net dot whatever the rest of your DNS is, whatever the rest of your domain is called, if somebody here goes to all.net, that's where it'll find it. And you can try that as an experiment. It's very interesting, except, of course, somebody decides all.net, because that's my site, and we always want them to be referred to.
Denial of service, of course, kills subnet links. So I can, if I deny service to the domain name server, then I can make it so that you can't reach the world.
Right? If I wipe out your domain name services, if I hit enough of those IP addresses that are DNS servers with some sort of denial of service attacks, then you won't be able to look up names. And the vast majority of the internet will fall over. Now, we understand. Yes, sir?
We're dependent on the IP address.
I was just going to say that, yes. If you use the IP address instead of the name, the domain name system never gets involved. It'll work just great. But if you type in a name instead of the IP address, which is what almost everybody always uses, because people really remembering 207.47. I don't even remember what. It's hard for most people. Now, of course, I remember 24.1.84.100 and 146.246.243.31 and 204.7.229.1 through 255, because I own those domains. But if I try and tell you, oh, yeah, just go to 204.7.229.3 website, that's not going to work as well as all.net or gm.com, right? Or, you know, just go to Buy America. It works better because people remember mnemonics better. So in the reality, much of the internet operates on these names and not on the numbers. Okay, furthermore, the numbers may change, but the names tend to remain the same. So all.net has had different IP addresses, but it's always been all.net. Okay? So that's another whole set of issues surrounding the use of those names versus the numbers. Yes, sir?
Yeah. So when you run a search on the internet, for example, say you're doing all the research,
when you do a search with all the Vista,
I can say I'm searching for all.net. Now, you have submitted your IP address on all the Vista for them to deal with. So
no, when I go to the search engines, they typically organize by name, not by IP address. Okay. Most databases are organized by name, not by IP address. Most lookup services go by name, not by IP address. In fact, things get very tricky. Most hashing, you know, there's all this hashed information sitting out in places like search engines, right, that maybe you deleted it from your server, but it's still there in their cached copy. So when somebody forges a name and puts out a bunch of information, you can't even remove it. There's no mechanism for removal of old information from the internet. Okay? Think about this in terms of cryptographic keys. Okay, there's no revocation mechanism. Once somebody like publishes a key, even though it's no longer any good because somebody stole it, there may not be any way to get rid of it. So it'll still work. But there are all sorts of issues related to that. But we'll get there.
Let's see, we have, so if we flood or deny service to the DNS, we can kill a lot of the ability to link between systems. Packet flooding can be used to corrupt the DNS. Like, you might be able to flood a whole bunch of DNS cross-domain responses into the DNS, and it'll start to believe some of them, and it'll poison its cache with the wrong information. Okay? Same, this is request flood. So you can overrun the DNS cache just by requesting it to look up a bunch of stuff. You can overrun it, and it'll run out of cache space. Now, there are different ways to handle it, but some DNSs, at least until very recently, most DNSs, essentially, when they ran out of cache space, the system crashed, and they couldn't service DNS anymore.
They never took that into account.
Nowadays, a lot of them have figured this out because they ran out of memory, and so they crash every few weeks or months, and then they finally realize it, so they fix that. But all you have to do is overrun them, and you can force a lot of domain name lookups, which slows the whole internet service for that person down. So you might be able to slow somebody's service down by a factor of 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 by simply flooding them with a lot of requests for domain name information that they don't have. And they'll cache the results, and then they'll run out of their own cache and throw out the addresses that they really want to get to and have to go look those up on disk or go out to the internet all the time. I don't want you to think that those are the only services. There are lots of other services. I sort of want to walk through some of the samples, give you a sense of what's out there. These asterisks mean that these protocol elements can cause protocol viruses if the source is equal to the destination, or if it's attached in some sort of loop, and I'll review that in just a few seconds. Okay, so SysTap is a UDP service, or also called WHO, that's supposed to give you the system status. Here's how it works. I send you a UDP packet that has SysTap. This is, by the way, it's in standard 24. That's right. They've actually moved the request for comments off standard. Some of them are actually now standards. So standard 24, after 20 years, the request for comments with no comments became a standard. So now it's standard that this will break your system instead of just a commentary that will. So what happens here is the datagrams have a source port and destination port. So I have to check some of a bunch of data. SysTap request requires no data. It says, send me the status of your system, which might be the result of a PS command or some other command that's run or some program that's run in the system. It might just be a message that says, sorry, can't answer that. Or no. Hey, whatever it is, doesn't matter. It'll send the answer back to the source port where the message originated. Okay? So now, there's no contents of the packet. So whatever datagram is sent, it'll send its answer back. There's no checking of syntax or anything like that. There is no syntax. So imagine what will happen if I make the source port the same as the destination port. Okay? And I make the source IP address the same as the destination IP address. Okay? The request comes in to your IP address, we'll call it 1.2.3.4. Port, what's the SysTap port? Anybody know what the SysTap port is? It's in your slash etc. slash services file, but I don't remember off the top of my head. Suppose it's 7. 7 is the echo port. Works the same way. Okay, whatever. So I send it to the SysTap port, and I make it so that the POM address is also 1.2.3.4, and the source port is also the SysTap port. When that SysTap command is received, your listener will listen on that UDP port and say, oh, I have to send the result back. It'll send it back to the same port that it's sending it from. When it receives that response, it will say, oh, that's a SysTap request. And it'll send a response to itself. And when it receives that response, it'll send a response to itself, and it's an infinite loop. There's no checking. There's a single datagram required. So you send one packet to this box, it's going to be talking to itself from now to eternity, shoving bits to itself. Okay. Now that attack is commonly used to crash a box. Now we tested this, and in fact, you have to send two packets to crash most boxes. Because they have enough compute. The load average gets very high if you only send one packet. But it doesn't quite have enough oomph to take itself down with a single bit. But on the second packet, it's down. It just overwhelms itself and can't do anything else because servicing network packets is a high priority. Okay, now you could make servicing network packets a very low priority, but then you would drop a lot of packets if it was doing anything else. So this has to do with the priority interrupt system and how you prioritize things in your operating environment. And since this is poorly done in most systems, the priority is almost certainly rigged so that the network packet has a higher priority than disk I.O. So if you start running enough of these processes, or they start stuffing enough into memory, or they start happening often enough, you'll never be able to access your disk. And if you can never access your disk, you can never, for example, page anything in and out, including the process that's being used to do this handling. So when it comes to where you've run out of memory
it has to page the process out, and it can't get a disk interrupt to page it out. The system will crash because there's no other option, and it gets a kernel panic. Because it can't get a high enough priority to service the packet. Because the packet's too high a priority, it overwhelms anything else it might do to service the packet.
The same is true of echo packets. So by the way, suppose I make the source and the destination different IP addresses.
But I still have the echo, the sysad port on both of them. Sorry? Yeah, not the original sender. You can make it the original sender. Just somebody else's IP address. What'll happen? Well, they'll talk to each other. There'll be an infinite loop of sending packets to each other. So you can take down two at a time, plus the intervening infrastructure. So if they're on a LAN, they may overwhelm the LAN. But suppose I want to like take out some portion of the internet. I rig a whole bunch of hosts that span this portion of the internet to be bouncing packets back and forth to each other at an enormous rate. And those hosts may not crash because there's only so much bandwidth in between them, and I can take down the intervening sets of infrastructure. And in fact, if I aim sets of these and understand enough about the topology of the network in between them, I can intentionally slow or disable portions of the network over extended periods of time. And everybody will be pointing in all sorts of different directions for where this is coming from and what it's doing, and they will never be able to tell. In fact, I can launch it from 500 or 600 different sites, throwing packets out every once in a while to different places, and it'll be very, very difficult for a defender to coordinate this. Okay? So just think about this. Now, I'm going to make it a little bit more difficult. Suppose I do that, but then I don't have to have the destination port the same as the source port. Suppose I make the source port just that, the destination port echo. Echo, whatever you send it, it sends back. Okay, so in one system you'll have a sysad, in the other system you'll have an echo. And they'll bounce back in an infinite loop between themselves. Okay, now we have sysad echo J time quote charge in, which just generates characters forever. All of these are susceptible, so I can combine any of them with any others. Now I have 500 machines throughout the internet that are sending different from and to hosts, different source and destination IP port numbers for these UDP packets. And I'm just creating this enormous packet storm, wiping out portions of the internet. Very hard to trace back. Almost, you know, any method they're using to trace it back probably uses the internet, right? I only send a couple packets every few minutes from each of these 500 places. So my packets are unlikely to be detected out in this, you know, enormous gobs and gobs of packets that are being shoved all over the internet. Very nasty. There's the file transfer protocol, which is what we use typically to transfer files between machines. This has a bunch of problems that we'll get to maybe at some point. Here it is, FTP data. So it doesn't just use one port. There's one port for control, another port for data. And then there's additionally, in order to run, it starts transmissions with another source coming from where you talked to that has to talk to you in order to finish the communication. There's actually three ports used on each machine, and they have to be the sync packet for the ports have to come from the originator for two of them and from the recipient on the other one. So there has to be a way back from the recipient to the originator where they can originate a TCP session in order for FTP protocol to work. Now this turns out to make firewalling very difficult, and hopefully we'll get to that later. But for now, we'll move on. Telnet, terminal-like access. This is what we use all the time, telnet. We use terminal access from machine to machine. Of course, you can sniff the packets. You've seen off-the-internet attacks that allow you not only to sniff the packets, but to take over a session, introduce your own commands in, and then allow the original user to not know that it got taken over. They just continue to work properly. Okay? So that's not too strong. That's the SMTP Simple Wall Transfer Protocol. This one has an asterisk because on an average of 6 new vulnerabilities have been found per year since 1995, all due to implementation errors. Almost all of which give root access. Okay, so I think it's down from every 2 months to every 3 months at this point. I guess they're running out of holes, or maybe the attackers are just getting bored.
But so if you allow mail services via a simple mail transfer protocol, it's almost a bloody guarantee that you're going to have some vulnerability if you run the standard mail handlers. And most of the standard mail handlers have been found to have such vulnerabilities. Time server that provides time information that allows you to synchronize, among other things, you can synchronize clocks over the internet to within about a millisecond of of the atomic clocks. Right? So I have a computer at home that is within a millisecond of the atomic clock at the Naval Observatory at all times. Turns out time synchronization is a very important issue in trying to look at things across the network, because if your clock says it's 2 a.m. and mine says it's 4 p.m. next Tuesday, and you get my detail audit record back that says, look, at 3 a.m. this happened, and then you happen to be in the Netherlands, that was 3 a.m. in the Netherlands, but that was 3 a.m. in the Netherlands relative to 2 o'clock in the afternoon next Tuesday, which is where your clock is set to right now, which is not where my clock is. So in order to figure out actual times, we have all this time skew stuff that we have to deal with. Whereas if you use the network time protocol, then you're very accurate to within the universal time, within milliseconds, and you can really tell when things happen. Of course, that doesn't mean that, that means your audit records will be according to some standard, but everybody else's may not be. Okay, so this notion of correlating information from different places depends on the relative times at which things happen, which is a very complicated thing to figure out, especially when you don't have access to the other system to say what time it is. Okay, which is what, you know, they might use the firewall to say, well, we're not going to let you have time service for some reason or something. Name server, that's how you provide the host name, that's the DNS system. Who is, that's to locate users. So I can go to your computer and say, who is Fred? And now, most computers in the internet will tell you all sorts of wonderful information about me, but a few of them are configured so they don't know who Fred is, at which point they'll say, I don't know. It might also tell you all the users logged into the system and their office numbers, their phone numbers, all sorts of other good intelligence information if you wanted to break in to their system. Boot server is used for remote boot up of systems. So you can run a boot server so that other systems on your network that say, I want to boot up, can call that boot server and it'll give them the operating system, the kernel of the operating system they need to boot up with. Okay? So, of course, if you can forge boot server packets, then you can implement any kernel, any operating system you want on all the other machines in your network. So if you figure out what the boot server machine is, you crash the boot server machine, you take over its IP address, when anybody goes to boot their system, you load your kernel, and on top of your kernel, whatever kernel they were expecting, and you did. From then on, you own their system until forever, I guess. It probably even changes, so from now on, instead of booting to the other boot server, it boots to you. Host names, that's a list of local host names. You can, just an internet service. We have OSI over TCP. OSI is the Open Systems Interconnect. Now, this is, you know, alphabet soup. The Open Systems Interconnect Protocol is published by the International Standards Organization, ISO. Okay? So this is the OSI protocol made by ISO. So it's the ISO-OSI protocol. And I think the OSS is the Open Security Standard, which associates with the OSI and the ISO. And just to confuse a little bit more, in California we have the ISO, which is the Independent System Operator that runs the power grid. So, you know, alphabet soup is what it is. It's hard to make everything three character initials, but when you have 50 million locations, you run out. Let's see. So what this does, it allows you to run one protocol over another. It's a form of tunneling. In fact, I can run IP over IP. So within the IP, I run my own IP datagrams on top of it. I can run IP and TCP. So that over a terminal connection, I'm running IP within that terminal connection, and I run all the IP services through that one terminal connection. Or if you allow mail, I can run IP over email. Somebody actually implemented a full IP operation that works through email. So all you have to do is be able to run this program on your computer and have email access to the internet.
and it'll use email in both directions to get unlimited internet access for you through your firewall. Now, it's not very fast. Okay, IP over email, right? Every packet gets emailed. It gets received and responded to via email. It's not real blazingly fast, but it works. Okay, so this is generally how the Turing property is, right? This is what a Turing machine is. It's a machine that can implement any other machine within itself, including itself. Okay? It's the nature of the mathematical space that computing, general purpose computing, lives in. And an example of that is the ability to tunnel one protocol over another. And of course, under that protocol, you can tunnel another and another and another. So if you allow any protocol back and forth between two places and allow people to have programs at either side that they define, then they can tunnel any other protocol through there. So any protocol you allow to pass through your firewall, if there's an insider working with an outsider, you've given an unlimited open hole through your firewall. Done deal. Okay? Fundamental limitation of firewalls. We have UUCP half lookup, a Unix copy program. It's the precursor of a lot of what internet does is used to copy files, used to send mail and so forth before we had these other protocols working very well. And Unix copy, one of the things it does is say, copy the path from here to there. And if you send this out, then every cooperating UUCP host along the way will say, well, here's how you got here, and here's how I can get to there, to the next hop. So it'll map your network for them. Right, so I can use it to map. It'll say, well, I ran through this router, and then I changed IP address, and I went through here, and I'm in this class C, and I jumped over to here. And you look all those things up. Oh, I see. This is the service provider for them, and they actually run through here, and they actually go through there. You get a nice map of the network, and if you do enough of that from different places, you can coordinate yourself a pretty darn good map of somebody's network. What's where? If you're interested in network news transfer protocol, NNTP, and the vulnerabilities associated with it, as several of these other protocols, you can go to the series of articles that I wrote at all.net called Internet Holes. Now under network security management or managing network security, they're a couple years old, but they still work today. Yes? That's right, bugs from a couple years ago still work today because the internet is backward compatible. Largely, you know, so whatever the bugs were yesterday, in order to work, it all has to still be bugs today, I guess. Maybe they'll fix some of them eventually. But so as it turns out, NNTP could also be used to map your network and do various other things, do flooding and forgery and all sorts of stuff. There's network time protocol, which is this protocol that does its millisecond timing. The other one is the time of day clock. That BIOS service for PC support, it provides the BIOS. The basic input-output system of your PC can be provided over the network by somebody else. So it's not the whole operating system. It's only the part of the operating system that handles all the interrupts, which is probably even better. That BIOS is a clear vulnerability. Simple network management protocol has lots of vulnerabilities. Again, the internet holds the details. We have TFTP, the Trivial File Transfer Protocol. The ones with asterisks on this page are all commonly used for attacks. Note that there aren't a whole lot left that aren't commonly used for attacks. Although all of these are used for attacks. Trivial File Transfer Protocol sends out, it says, send me this file, and if the listening machine responds, it sends you the file, all with UDP packets. So I send off a UDP packet that says, send me your password file, and some reasonable portion of all the machines of the internet will send you their password file. Now you run crack, and if you happen to get a password, you know, 10% of the passwords are like the user ID spelled forward or backwards, or the first or last name of the user spelled forward or backwards. So odds are very good that if you get a password file, you'll get into the machine, 80-90% of the time. In fact, many times you get many, many passwords. The machine. Many times you find some of the user IDs don't have passwords at all, and you can just log in without a password for those users. RJE, remote job entry. This is so I want to submit a program to run on your computer. I use the remote job entry system. Now, it turns out, in the days of big computers, remote job entry was a very popular service, but these days, people don't accept much remote job entry. Still, if you can do remote job entry, chances are
If you can somehow send the user ID and password, you can submit a job to run on their computer. And once you have a process running on their computer, you can become root and take over the computer and all the other remote jobs and so on and so forth. Usually it's for a server too, so it gives a better target. Stinger gives you information on users, often used in attacks. A couple examples are input overflows that have been used to corrupt programs. So you send in more input bits than it's ready to handle, and it overruns the stack and starts writing the input bits you sent all over the executing part of the program, which eventually, when it gets to one of your instructions, then gives you control of their computer, and it's typically run as root on the remote system so that you now own that system as soon as you get one of your instructions executed. Also, of course, giving out information on users, which is good for intelligence. You say, oh, here's the phone number of Betty, who works in accounting. Hello, Betty. Hi, this is Joe over in the controller's office. We're having some problems with our access. Could you please change your password to such and such? And then we'll be able to access the database. Yeah, well, we'll just get in for a minute. Just need to get the Johnson account. Another thing I found out from your website, right? You have the Johnson account. Okay, no problem. Hang on. Now you're into the system. Okay, Betty, you can change it back now. Thanks a lot. Yep, bye. Okay, so that kind of intelligence information is an easy way to then exploit perception management to break into the system. You have the Ingress block for database operations, which if people were running Ingress might be a vulnerability, but not run too much anymore, so it's good. The exec, remote execution of programs, is often used. Basically, the remote execution does not have strong authentication. In fact, in many cases, it doesn't have any authentication. You just say, oh, run this program, and it does it. Or it does it based on IP address. Run this program, oh, and here's the source IP address, the UDP packet. So you go, oh, here's a bunch of UDP packets, run this program, and oh, it's from this guy you trust. Okay, I'll do it. Runs the program. Program opens up, you know, unlimited service to you from your attacker. Login is used for remote logins. Implementation errors and poor authentication make it vulnerable. The shell is remote shell execution. Configuration errors allow remote entry, for example, if it's very common that there will be some error in the password file that's used for Yellow Pages or name service that allows remote shell from certain IP addresses without password and so forth. Remote printer services, a variety of things. There are input overflows that have been used to exploit that. But there's another one that's maybe more interesting from my perspective because it's different. That is, I sent you a very big remote print job that prints one letter per page. So it prints X and then a form feed, X and then a form feed. And within a few minutes, your stack of 500 sheets of paper there is all printed over. Can't reuse it because it has an X on every page. Similar to the fax attack where I send you a fax and I put a loop of paper in the fax with a line down the middle. So it just runs through. It's very quick. It doesn't take much time to read that those bits of that line. And it just draws a straight line through all your fax receiving paper. Especially when paper was expensive, it was a very nasty attack. In about a minute or two, you can run through a whole roll of fax paper. It's the same thing, just scratches your printer and stuff, running out of paper. Oh, let's see what else is new. Unless you think I'm going to run out, how many internet services are there? Say 65,000 is the maximum number, but it's not fully populated. There are only maybe 1,000 or two. So I don't have time to run through all 1,000. I'm just going to run through 50 or 60 today. I wouldn't want to bore you. Unix Unix Copy Daemon. That's the daemon that runs Unix Unix Copy, Tomcat for communications of some sort. Nobody actually knows what it does as far as I can tell. And I think it's documented somewhere, but it's very rarely used. No vulnerabilities that I'm aware of have ever been found in it, but that doesn't mean there aren't any. The Who daemon asks who is logged in. It's just like these other daemons. If they give you intelligence, you can exploit it. Remote monitor, that allows you to remotely monitor the operations of a system. Yeah, okay. Hey, I want to see whether my attacks are succeeding or whether the system is slowing down because of these packets. I'll just go use my remote monitoring capability. Plug in the remote monitor and watch what happens. I can measure the effect of my attacks. Error log copy daemon is used to copy the error log. If you get into this thing, then you might be able to cause it to not copy the attacks and errors that you induce through your attack. If you can defeat the error logging capability, then you can try forever and they'll never detect it. We have the X server, which is the X11 Windows server. Now, the X server is notorious. This has
Usually runs on port 6000 and through 6000 something or another.
And for example, it has been hacked to allow remote viewing of and control of X services.
So you have your screen here
that's running some sort of X11 service, and I can go in and watch. I can get a copy of everything on your screen. I can watch what you type. I can type on your behalf. I can open a window you don't know about on some screen you're unaware of and start typing into it and get my answers back. Right? All of this done remotely from over the internet without you ever knowing anything about it.
Okay. X services can be very dangerous.
I'm either published on the internet like that. NFS, network file sharing, is used to allow you to make part of your file system available to the world. Now, the most common thing is that people export their file system to the whole world read-write with root access, right? So you go, you say, oh, I'm going to mount your root file system on my box. Or you can do this through Windows. Most Windows and Windows NT systems that allow file sharing, especially file servers, very often misconfigured. So over the internet, I can sort of, mount your whole server read-write to root. Or at least the part of your server that then lets me modify the access control so I can mount the rest of your server with unlimited access from over the internet. So I can change your password files, delete all your programs, replace your programs, delete all your information, read, write, destroy, augment, change, anything and everything in your system now and into the future. Okay? That's not so happy. So you certainly don't want this running out over the internet if you can avoid it. It also runs UDP so that there's no authentication and so on and so forth. And it's generally not encrypted. So if anybody's running NFS SOM SMB service over the internet, it's likely to be a glaring hole that can be exploited for unlimited access to that system and other systems that trust it or connect to it. Of course, once you get into one system, you can leap off to the next one from that control. NIS, Network Information Services, also known as Yellow Pages. This is how you have one password file that services a whole domain. So instead of having to maintain a separate password file on each of 1,000 computers, you have one password file and all the other computers just refer to it. There are lots of internet programs that will go and essentially ask for all the lines of the password file. The way NIS works is you say, I have a user ID here. Can you tell me what the password line looks like from the password file so I can check the password? So it'll hand you that line. So if you simply say user 0, user 1, user 2, and so forth, up to user 65, 5, whatever, 539, whatever the biggest one, 2 to the 16th minus 1 is, it'll give you every line of the password file. So that's a good way to steal a password file, then you run crack, and 90% of the time you get a password, and you're in. Meander, global file system. Is something that the root of your file system, your root slash dot dot becomes the root of the next level up of the internet. So anybody that is running Andrew file system is potentially allowing the whole internet to access them as if they were a local file in their system, and so forth. HTTPD, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol Daemon. Is that right? Transfer, yes. Which is AKA the web, what the World Wide Web runs on. Again, note the asterisk, these are commonly used for attacks. More things are commonly used for attacks than are not, which is to say that it's common to have vulnerabilities in everything. So here are some examples of exploits against the HTTP daemon. By the way, you can look at the, in the Internet Holes article series, you can read 50 ways, I think it's in the 50 ways series, 50 ways to defeat your World Wide Web system, which will explain lots more ways to get at HTTP. But common things are CGI bin, common gateway interface, binary. These are programs that when you send a web request, it actually gets interpreted as the input of a program. The program either does a back-end database lookup or some other function and so forth. So there are a lot of these programs that have input overflows. So you just send it too many bits and the extra bits become part of the stack, and then they overrun the stack, they become part of the program. And so if you put in the right bits, then they run your program instead of their program, typically as root or at least some authorized user on the file server, and this is the vast majority of the break-ins happen because of such things. Another common one is CGI bin programs allow remote command execution. So you have a command, you send a request that says something like, the format is get space
you know, slash name slash, you know, slash Joe slash index.html, but then you add a back quote and a cat space slash et cetera slash password, and then another back quote. And if it's piped to a command interpreter along the way, then what happens is it actually runs that program and shoves out the password file to you in addition to whatever other thing it would feed you. And there are all sorts of such vulnerabilities. Instead of just counting the password file, you can, for example, open up a root shell to yourself over the internet with such things.
It also, of course, works under NT systems and other such systems. They just have different formats for these things than Unix systems. So it's not more secure, particularly be running on NT. Configuration errors grant write access to the server. That's another very common one.
Right? Some directory is improperly protected and it has write access. You write something into the server, which becomes a CGI bin, for example. You then run the thing that you just wrote, which is now running as a program on that machine, and it starts out a shell, and now you can count that in and you're logged into that computer, or have it do other functions for you, go to the back end of the database.
Web-based management interfaces are also exploitable to allow takeover. So we very commonly now see that the way you manage a web server, or in fact the way you manage a large database,
is by some web browser. And you push buttons on the web browser and it sends the commands through HTTP.